First You Think is a not-for-profit ministry of the First Unitarian Church of Des Moines. Support us at ucdsm.org today.
One Saturday night, years and years ago, when my daughter was a little baby, I leaned over her crib to lift her out, and I couldn't stand up. I had thrown out my lower back. This had never happened before. I placed her kind of awkwardly down and moved kind of horizontally away, completely bent with blinding pain. I couldn't stand up or sit down or lie down or do anything except whimper and gasp and beg for ibuprofen. I was a mess. Ross called somebody at the church to say I wasn't coming in the morning, and I was relieved and mortified by that. It was the first and only time I ever missed a Sunday. And over the next few days, I struggled not just with unaccustomed pain, but with something else, a kind of crisis. I felt embarrassed and ashamed that I couldn't go to work and keep commitments and do the job I loved. I was afraid about what that meant. I felt guilty and forlorn that I couldn't care for my own child. I was afraid about that. I was frustrated and impatient. I was so angry that my body had betrayed me. After all I've done for you, I said to my lumbar spine, all this exercise, all the time, all this walking, all this healthy food, and you go and let me down. This was a crisis about identity. My sense of myself as a strong, young, capable agent, fully in command of my intentions, the girl who never makes mistakes, my time, my relationships, my dreams, my work, all in order. My back got better in a week or two, but the disruption to my core being was permanent. And this was a good thing. This is good. The aftershocks are still reverberating all these years later, still shaking up my understanding of what it means to be a person, a good person, good enough. And concepts like capable, strong, able, worthy, healthy, whole, independent, interdependent, vulnerable, human, embodied, mortal, grateful, okay. As in, most of the time, I am so grateful to be just okay. Invincible was never a reliable identity. That same winter, I was leading a class at church, a little study group on prayer. And the people shared stories and memories from childhood and written reflections about what prayer was for them, what it does and doesn't do, what it means and does not mean, and to whom or what they prayed, if they prayed at all, and with what ancient words, sacred words, or made-up words, or silences. It took a while, but then people just poured it out. They talked about daily practice and poems taped to their refrigerator or their bathroom mirror. They talked about 12-step programs and the simultaneous translation that goes on in there. One person said she doesn't pray at all, but every time she hears a siren, she just closes her eyes and she just draws a breath and sends a silent blessing to whoever it is, remembering the night years ago, decades ago, when she was a child and an ambulance carried away her grandma. They talked about praying in words, praying in marching, praying in music, in gardening, and they talked about Hail Mary and the Our Father and the Kaddish for the dead. In the last session, we went around the circle and everybody read from their journals. They shared a prayer or something that sustained them or something they had written. And one woman, the last to speak, was pretty new to the congregation. And she said, well, I brought a prayer for our minister. I wrote a prayer for our pastor here because I don't think she knows anything whatsoever about this topic. And I was like, wait, what? And she said to me, would you pray with us, Reverend? And she handed me her paper, what she had written, and asked me to read it out loud to the group. It was this, a good UU prayer for Victoria. O infinite universe that gives me all I say and do, surround me as I walk in beauty. Thank you, Mother, Father, God, for the healing that takes place now. Hear me as I speak silently, speak loud and clear to me as I listen. Thank you for the love that you allow unobstructed to flow through me. I trust that life supports me. I rest well with the knowledge of my work well done. I trust that love surrounds me and that I have all I need. I am held, nurtured, loved. When I am tired, I sleep. When I ache, I am held. When I'm cold, I'm warmed. There is no doubt that hope can be lifted and held with love. And what she meant here was the great wild life-sustaining hope that she knew that I struggle to lift up as if with a hydraulic crane every week. The hope and love and faith that hold us all in our orbits and anchor us to each other and to history and holiness, the hope and love and faith that bind us to our ancestors and our descendants and will not let us go no matter what. She knew that it's a mighty work for me to lift that up every week. And what she also meant was my little baby, who was maybe 3 months old at the time, whose name actually is Hope, and whom I still could not carry at that point because of my stupid back. She wrote, "There is no doubt that hope can be lifted and held with love, always safely within my arms. Thank you for this time to know well my place. I welcome your strength. I am honored to be chosen to serve. O infinite universe that gives me all I say and see I do and do. Surround me as I walk in beauty." Her name was Jackie Meadows. And so once again, for the second time that same month, I was utterly disrupted. Everything I thought I knew, everything I thought I had learned so well in divinity school, in chaplaincy training, in college, everything I thought I knew about humility, courage, invincibility, was slapped down lovingly and reassembled by the people in that circle as they heard me read those words. My understanding of my role as minister and the people's role as ministers. And who cares for whom, who teaches whom, who's blessing whom with sacred power, who holds the center of our UU faith and knows what's best and what restores the soul. My orientation to all of this was utterly and permanently disrupted, and that was good, and it is good. And I still pray that prayer out loud all these years later to remind me. The injury disrupted me, and then vulnerability disrupted me, and then kindness disrupted me, as it does. And each time I've never been the same. And it's not as if the fix is permanent, as if I were cured and converted once and for all my hubris and tight-fisted self-reliance, that individualism, this ridiculous bootstrap theology. But when I feel it start to calcify, like a spiritual stiffness in the lumbar spine of the soul, I try to stay ever more open to cosmic surprises, good things, hard things, all the twists and turns that slap us down and wake us up and rearrange every assumption. It happens all the time, right? We crave order and control and predictable patterns in this life. We search for them. And when we can't find them, because mostly they don't exist, we get anxious and we make them up, imposing our will or opinion and expectations of ourselves and everybody else all over the place. And when the universe rears up on its hind legs and says, "Well, actually, no, you are not the boss of all things, and this is not how it's going to go," we are mightily disrupted. It happens all the time. Our bodies betray us, betray our delusions of eternal youth. The weather betrays us, or rather betrays our ridiculous self-centeredness within the natural world. Hurricanes happen, earthquakes, floods. Southern California is buried in 12 feet of snow while glaciers melt and fires rage. People betray us, sometimes with cruelty, and sometimes because they just have to so that they can stay true to their own integrity. Lovers leave, loved ones die. Dreams are upended and expectations undone. Outcomes which we thought were guaranteed, health, wealth, longevity, life, liberty, happiness, they turn out to be nowhere written in the contract. Nothing guaranteed. Uprisings fill the street with righteous rage, and that's a good thing. Rioters storm the Capitol, threatening democracy itself, and that's not a good thing. But our new awareness of the danger, our renewed commitment to defending equality and justice, that is not a bad thing. that vigilance. So how we weather the disruptions, how we welcome them sometimes, or at least acknowledge them, honor them, how we grieve completely when loss assails us, how we keep on moving forward, how we let go of this idea, this dream, and reorient our mind, spirit, our plans around new reality. That is the religious life. That game, that challenge, that invitation to recalculate. Change and cosmic surprises that are wonderful and terrible, they are the baseline, not the exception to the rule. And through all this windy turmoil, how do we stay fully present to ways of being that are grateful, humble, curious, awake, ways of growing wiser, deeper, ways of loving more bravely, freely, honestly, as if there were nothing to lose? A few years ago, Siri joined our household. Siri, the smart sprite inside the phone, who guides us now so efficiently through recipes and road construction. And before Siri and her Android cousins showed up, before Google Maps and ChatGPT replaced the mind of God, I remember we had some other GPS prototype giving driving directions, and I swear, every time we deviated from the route it wanted us to take, every time we made a wrong turn, the voice in the machine, the ghost in the machine, would give this little irritated sigh or a little tisk before it said through its clenched, robotic, passive-aggressive teeth, whatever, recalculating, and got us back on track. Siri is much more professional and spiritually mature, as if she knows that few things in this life are predictable or controllable, and that how we stay steady, how we stay true to ourselves and each other and our deepest values, that is the true journey. Siri knows it's all about recalculating all the time. I think of Bruce Kramer, the dean at the University of St. Thomas here in St. Paul, who for 5 years wrote this devastatingly beautiful blog, a spiritual memoir about living while dying, in his case from ALS. And his book, based on all these posts, is called We Know How This Ends. But the book is not depressing. It is poignant and funny and compassionate. He is a wise and not morose companion. He wrote in the first pages unflinchingly what Bill shared with you about devastation, about being healthy and young on one day and receiving a death sentence the next. But then he goes deeper and he gets braver. And he's still chronicling grief and rage and disappointment and terror, but never wandering into the shallows of why me, which is never a good question. He wrote about transforming what felt like a death sentence into a life sentence and beginning to name and number and nurture the things that make life good life, some of which are not only diminished, but were somehow illuminated by his circumstance. And he never talked about silver linings or making lemonade, but he did talk about gratitude and joy and work well done and wisdom gained and friendship. He said, listen, this is quoting now, a pronouncement like you have ALS or you have a stage 4 tumor or you have Alzheimer's obfuscates all other sound. Yet it also focuses you with the precision of a laser, forcing your attention like a slap in the face or a plunge into ice cold water. There is incredible noise that goes with a terminal diagnosis, but there is also quiet clarity, purpose, feeling. I have likened ALS, he said, to death by a thousand paper cuts. And I try not to dwell on this aspect, but the progressive weakening of my body, I know it's there. But honesty begets urgency. I know now it isn't enough to work. It isn't enough to love my family. It isn't enough to connect with friends. It all needs to be done with passion, abandon, love, and light. There is no time to hold grudges, be afraid, and not forgive. There's no time for games. Play? Yes. But all the tricky, petty little games we let ourselves get sucked into? No time. I tell friends now, I love you, and I am not embarrassed. I tell colleagues, I say it over and over till they aren't afraid to say it back to me, to my face. And the tears stream down and I don't care. I just don't have time for bullshit anymore. That is the gift of urgency. Would I trade it for the years I'm not going to have? I honestly don't know. And who of us really has any idea how urgently beautiful everything is? Bruce Kramer draws this distinction between disease and dis-ease, being shaken from complacency, from isolation into full awareness of living and loving and dying. He writes, disease takes you to the precipice of horror. Dis-ease offers beautiful vistas there of hurt and healing and hope. And as he started to talk about his diagnosis early on, he noticed family and friends and coworkers sharing their own stories more openly of cancer, depression, loneliness, addiction. I realized, he says, that their storylines were awakenings. They were profound connections in the moment of shared revelation that each of us carries uneasiness, unacknowledged, but always present. Each of us is always processing constantly what reality means. My diagnosis just revealed these rocky shores beneath all of our lives and how we have to hold on to each other. He never wrote about being glad to be sick, but he spoke with gratitude and wonder about this unbidden opportunity to recalculate everything. There are less drastic opportunities all the time. In the other reading, Lewis Hyde offers all these fantastic real-life snapshots of accidents and upsets that push the reset button on what seemed like fixed reality. The crack in the ice where otters are breathing. The unexpected tears that save a man from power. The hungry children who wander house to house eating till the neighbors have all become neighbors. The teacher's errors in which the children and students ripen, boy children stuttering in the gun shop. A hailstorm in South Dakota that started the farmers' cooperative in 1933, the picnic basket that slips overboard and leads to the invention of the lobster trap. These errors are the sign of love. Sometimes things happen for no reason, no good reason, but meaning is made where there was no meaning before. Wisdom and kindness and insight find space where there was no space for them before. People change their minds, ships change course, a workaround is found that opens us to a new possibility. We do it all the time, recalculate what we thought we were, what we thought we were capable of, what we thought and now think matters. Hyde calls it the sign of love. When some accident or error message pops up on the screen. And I think that means our love of life, our love of this life on this earth, regardless of its disappointments, fully mindful of the risk of loss. Our love of life, our gratitude, people call it faith, is larger than our devotion to our little plans and expectations. We know this better now, having come through these first 3 years of the COVID-19 pandemic, right? 3 years ago, exactly today, is when most congregations shut down. And looking back, it is hard to remember how scared we were and how bewildered and undone. And what we've learned, not just about viruses and vaccination and technology and the inequities of capitalist healthcare, what have we learned about our own composition? What's changed, not just in ruins, but what has shifted in our wisdom, in our understanding of interdependence and love, true love? I think of this church, this beautiful community. All year, I've heard people say, and with such devotion, this church was so strong, so vibrant, so engaged and alive before. And then everything changed. Reverend Mark left or whatever happened. And that story may or may not be entirely true, but how you tell it, how you hold it, how you gather the strands everyone else is holding and carry it forward and weave those threads into a larger unfolding tapestry, that matters. All year I've been hearing, everything changed when Reverend Amy came or when they left. And you're all over the place about this, I know. But how you hold the story, the stories going forward, and how you hold each other now, that's what matters. As Bruce Kramer wrote before he died, there is just no time to hold grudges or be afraid and not forgive. There is no time for games. You've been mightily disrupted in the congregation in the way all churches have recently, and also in your own ways. But what path opens now? How are you mapping it together? It's as if the whole church exists in that moment when you see those three little dots on your phone, the ellipses that tell you to wait while somebody else is typing, but you're all the ones typing. You're the ones whispering in unison, recalculating, recalculating. And not only in anxiety or grief or resentment now, but with curiosity and even excitement. And even confidence and hope. And they're all justified. I've seen it. Will you pray with me? Take a breath. O infinite universe that gives us all we say and do, surround us as we go in beauty. Hear us as we speak silently. Speak loud and clear to us as we listen. Thank you for the love that you allow unobstructed to flow through us. We trust that life supports us. We trust that love surrounds us and that we have all we need. There is no doubt that hope can be lifted and held with love always safely within our arms. Thank you for this time to know well our place. We welcome your strength. We are honored to be chosen to serve. O infinite universe that gives us all we say and see and do, surround us as we go in beauty. Amen.